So hello, I'm Chris Hecker, and this is my talk, Achievements Considered Harmful. I wanted to get something out of the way really early so that we never have to speak about it again. We'll do that. And now that's the last time that will actually show up in the talk at all. There's another thing to get out of the way here, which is the title of my talk. This is a famous essay on the internet. And often when you do a talk entitled or a paper entitled Considered Harmful, you're kind of trying to stir shit up. And that's partially true, but I'm not actually really taking as much of a side here as you might expect. This is the title of my talk, but this is how you should really see my talk. This talk is actually a question mark, and this talk is actually aimed at developers, but also at psychologists. As you'll see, I think that we need a lot more research into some stuff that we're doing to know what the actual ramifications of it are. That research doesn't really exist. And so this is kind of a plea to psychologists to help us out here. So I am not one, a psychologist or a psychiatrist. That's totally clear. The psychologists themselves do not agree about the stuff that I'm going to talk about. There are some consensi, and I'll talk about those. But here's a great quote from one of these meta-analysis papers that I'm going to talk about. Despite the seeming objectivity of this technique, these meta-analytic reviews reach markedly different conclusions. Welcome to psychology research. And there are no direct studies about the stuff I'm going to be talking about. Now, you might be saying, wait, there's a ton of studies about achievements. Lots of people, and in fact, I'll give a reference to it. There's a talk tomorrow about achievements. These are studies about short-term achievement behavior. There are no studies about the kind of, in some sense, more philosophical characteristics that I'm going to talk about here. So there really aren't any studies that directly are studying the stuff I'm worried about happening in games. There are a ton of studies that are about stuff that are kind of analogous that made me concerned. Here's the talk tomorrow. The EDAR guys are giving it the same slot in the room down the hall. Okay. This lecture is not about how to like optimize your daily usage, daily active users by giving them more pink hats so you'll like monetize your whatever the fuck. Like, I don't care anything about that stuff. Like, I don't know anything about that stuff. Like, this is not what that lecture is about. Another kind of disclaimer is that when I'm playing games, I actually ignore achievements. I don't care about them. I don't actually have it turned off, but I don't pay any attention to it. So you might ask how I actually came to be doing a talk about this when they're not actually very important. I don't hate them. Some people like really hate them, and some people like really love them. And I'm just like, whatever. I just ignore it. Like something popped up, whatever. I'm in the middle of doing a play experience. So you might ask how I started thinking about this, and the answer to that is this. This is my 6-year-old, and you're all jealous of her Scribblenauts hat. I know. So when you have a kid who's in school and you're trying to be a responsible parent, you start reading a bunch of literature about parenting and the school environment and how education works and that sort of thing. And there's a guy who is kind of like one of the preeminent authors in this area, and his name's Alfie Cohn. He has written 12 or 20 books or whatever. Like he's a very well-known lecture circuit kind of thing. He's not a psychologist himself, I don't think, but he doesn't do any original research himself, but he reads a ton, he agglomerates and like summarizes research in a popular way. So his books are popular books, but they're based on research. Here's the book that I started reading last year that kind of got me thinking about this. And I started reading it about, for my daughter, not like reading it to her before bed, but you know what I mean. The Punished by Rewards, The Trouble with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, A's, Praise, and Other Bribes. So you can clearly it has a little bit of a bent to it. This book is like 400 pages long and talks about a ton of research. The first thing he does is takes this guy apart limb from limb. This is B.F. Skinner, a very famous psychologist who did a lot of research with pigeons and other and he created what's called operant conditioning. We're all familiar with this, and I'm not going to really go into it. But so there's two things about Skinnerian psychology. One is the low-level stuff, like actual hard results that his papers are about. Like, if I do this with a pigeon, they will do this, right? And, to some extent, and they did research on people as well. Here are some, you know, results that are tightly controlled, and they're scientific, and, they have error bars, and the whole works. But what Cohn starts with B.F. Skinner and talks about, you know, some of the generalizations up to human behavior that people make using Skinner's results that are at a much lower level. But also, the bigger thing that he rails against and that he's really concerned about is what he calls pop behaviorism. So behaviorism is the branch of psychology that Skinner sort of founded in the 50s. Pop behaviorism is this kind of this suffused idea throughout society, especially Western society and especially in the United States, where it's basically like, as Alfie Cohn says, do this and you'll get that. Right? It's contingent. I want you to do something. I want to manipulate your behavior, possibly for your own good, whatever. And I'm doing it by, and I want to do it by giving you something in exchange for you doing that. Okay? So that's kind of, that's what a lot of this research is about, this concept of rewards. And there's a lot of different forms rewards take, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but like that list on Alfie's book, is you know, some of the example of the breadth of the kind of rewards. And then recently, like last year, there was a TED talk by this guy Daniel Pink, who was a speechwriter for Bush or Clinton or somebody like that. He gave a TED talk, and I was watching this. This kind of went around the blogosphere and like, you know, boing boing type of like blog thing. And it's a fine talk. And I was like, wow, this guy totally like ripped off Alfie Skinner's stuff. Alfie Skinner. That's whoa, shot, sniper shot. Alfie Cohn's stuff, because Alfie Cohn's book came out in 93. And basically lays waste to the reward structures that are basically pretty much true in Western civilization, for work, child raising and education. Just goes nuts. This guy comes out and he's talking about a lot of the same stuff. And it's because almost no one knows about this outside of psychology circles. It's and they're good selling books for educational books about the theory of education, but you know what that means, right? So this guy starts summarizing this, and he's taking, you know, the delta between his book, which came out at the end of 2009, and Alfie Cohn's stuff, which was updated in 96. Like, there's been some more research that backs up some of this stuff. His book is called Drive, and it follows the kind of Malcolm Gladwell single syllabic, you know, like white cover with the word on it thing that everyone does these days. And so you've got these two books together. And these are good books. You should read these books. However, they're also just horrible books, because like most books like this, I don't know about you, but when I try and read these kind of business / psychology pop books, like, they're just numbingly repetitive. Like, dude just repeats himself and repeats himself. It's just insane. They also like are filled with anecdotes. Although they talk about a lot of research, they're constantly like making that the plural of anecdote is data error, you know. And finally, they're blatantly biased agendas. These guys have they already know what they think, and they've found a lot of research that backs it up. They might even be right, but you just read the book, and when I read books like this, I just get the hair on the back of my neck stands up, because it's just creepy. They're not written. They should be 100 pages long instead of 400 pages long, and they should, you know. So I went to the original papers. I did learn one thing. When Alfie Cohn was flaming some Skinnerians in another mail, and that I, you know, you do a bunch of research. I learned this cool word, tendentious. If you guys know this word, marked by a strong, implicit point of view, partisan, which is awesome that they were using this against somebody else, because they were doing it in the same way, and like it's a great word. Okay, so these guys did a lot of reference a lot of research, and here's an example of the kind of research that we're talking about here. So here is what's called a meta-analytic review. Edward Deci is one of the like fundamental guys in the kind of anti-rewards. There's no name for there's no anti-behaviorism. There's no name for that branch of psychology, I guess. It's actually the more preeminent branch now. It's kind of if you had the psychologist vote, they would think that behaviorism is pretty much out of fashion now. But anyway, but here you can see this. This is a meta-analytic review of 128 studies since the 70s. So there's a lot of data out there. However, this is psychology research we're talking about. I don't know how many people have seen this. And I was going to talk over this slide, but like, I mean, no one's going to listen to me while you're reading all the things. But it's basically that idea that kind of especially technical people have of like, you know, increasing rigor as you go towards mathematics, right? Like, you know, the poor sociologist person over in the corner is like, oh, and the, you know, the error bars are getting smaller and smaller until you finally get to math where there are no error bars because you're not actually trying to do anything that impacts anyone, right? But you're right. So as anyone who reads XKCD very often knows, there's alt text on XKCD. You mouse over it and it shows the alt text. And here's the alt text on this one. So besides being an awesome phrase, which I hadn't actually heard before, it also gets to the heart of the matter, which is to say that, like, math is, yes, incredibly rigorous, but you can't actually do a damn thing with it. Whereas physics, you can actually start to make predictions about the real world. And chemistry, you can actually start to make medicine. And biology, you can actually start to, like, you know, save animals or do, you know, do all kinds of, you know, prevent disease spread. And hopefully psychology, you can start to, you know, talk about behavior. So even though they're not as rigorous, we need to figure out how to use them. And science has done this. There are results in, even though we're not simulating biology at the quantum level, there are valid biological results, right? So it's not that these fields are useless, it's just that it gets harder, and it gets easier to doubt. So these are cute little animated GIFs of fMRI, functional magnetic resonance image data. So this is kind of, I kind of think of the F in functional magnetic resonance imaging could stand for functional, but also kind of stands for fetishized, because fMRI is like the great white hope of people who are on the math side of things and want to apply their results to the psychology side of things. People think that, oh, as soon as we get the fMRI, you know, good enough data, we'll be able to, like, really see inside the way Skinner was trying to by just, like, poking at the stimuli. And they think that, oh, we'll finally be able to answer the question. It's kind of like the behaviorists are just really holding out hope that the fMRI thing will save the day. And so that's some of that. I mean, I'm a kind of Cartesian in that sense as well. Like, I think we will eventually have hard AI. I'm a technology optimist, right? But at the same time, like, it's really hard to simulate things from the bottom up when it's as complicated as human psychology. And for this slide, I decided to do some research on how far they are on the kind of harder end of that, which is, like, I want to simulate, at the quantum level, I want to simulate, molecules. How close am I to, like, chemistry and biology? And the answer is, they can only study, they've studied two helium atoms next to each other. We have a long way to go before we can attack real world problems that direction, so we have to use the psychology data. I would, with all of you as my witness, this is the last lolcat I will ever use in a talk. Especially after having done all this research on extrinsic motivation, and then seeing a bunch of talks already, and it's only the first day with lolcats in them, and I'm just like, it's such a cheap way. You all should be, as I say every year, ashamed of yourselves for laughing at this lolcat, and I will never do it again. I promise. This is actually relevant, though, because what this whole thing reminds me of is the debate on global warming right now. And in fact, I woke up this morning, and here's the newspaper. If you can call USA Today a newspaper. Is the global warming movement cooling? That's right next to the awesome USA Today, like, graph that has the, like, number of Americans choosing cremation, which is the size of an urn, as the, like... This is about the... Look, it's the weather. This is about all the ClimateGate stuff that happened last year with the leaking of the emails and, like, these scientists talking about, like, you know, stuff that happens. Science is dirty, especially when you're talking about science at the psychology level or at, like, the planet. Like, you know, it's not yes or no, like, you know, questions you can answer about a quadratic equation or whatever. It's, like, really dirty, and, like, they don't know, and it's really hard to eliminate variables. There are thousand-dimensional equations that are trying to solve. Like, it's just, they don't, there are error bars. And unfortunately, the public's expectation of science is that it's precise. Like, once we do a study, you know the answer, and that's just not the way science actually works. And the problem with that is that it allows people who are, there can be a preponderance of scientific evidence with error bars, and you can see doubt that that's not actually how it works. You have a lot of leverage to seed doubt. So it reminds me, reading this, the back and forth between these researchers reminds me of kind of climate change research. So let's talk about this research. I'm not going to hide what the research shows and, like, do a big reveal or anything like that. I'm just going to start with that, and then we'll go from there. So the research shows that in most cases, and I'm going to define all these terms in a minute, extrinsic motivators are not only ineffective, but also are damaging by decreasing intrinsic motivation on interesting tasks. The preponderance of evidence shows this. I'll be a little more precise about this later, and you can read the research yourself. So I'm going to now do some anecdotes myself, and I'm doing really quick. Most of the talks about this kind of stuff, like Daniel Pink's talk, and when you read these books, are just like anecdote after anecdote, I mean, anecdotes drawn from these studies that, isn't this cool that this happened or whatever. I'm going to do it really briefly just to give you some idea of the breadth of these studies. So one of the famous studies about drawing, kids in preschool, they take a group of kids who all like to draw, they divide them in half, not the actual children, but take the two groups. They give some kids money or candy or whatever, I don't even remember in this case, an extrinsic motivator to draw. They come back the next day, the kids who got the motivator the day before don't draw anymore, and the kids who didn't keep drawing. Same thing, puzzles, divide them into three groups. Ones who, the control group who got nothing, just can you solve these puzzles for me, please? A group that got praise for solving the puzzles, and a group that got paid for solving the puzzles. I think these are college students. Interesting puzzles, like cool little, mind twister puzzles. They do the thing, they pay the people, they praise the people who are, whatever, and then they say, oh, I've got to go enter these results in the computer, which is a mainframe at the time, and so I've got to leave the room for 8 minutes. The guy goes away, looks into the mirror in that way that, like, psychologists work. The people who were praised and the people who were paid put the puzzles down and didn't touch them again. The people who were who were the control group kept playing with the puzzles. There's, like, a magazine and a couple other things to do in the room to, like, see. IQ tests, wearing seatbelts, paying people to wear seatbelts makes them wear seatbelts less. Trying new foods, they did a thing to test how transitive these temporary the results of this are. Yogurt drink that people hadn't had before, three groups, hey, can you drink this yogurt drink? Hey, good job drinking that yogurt drink, and here's some money to drink this yogurt drink. 3 weeks later, they had the people back in, the people who, the control group was like, yeah, give me some more of that yogurt drink, and the other ones wouldn't touch it, etc. Commissions and bonuses don't work. All of these studies, including from, like, finance schools in London, like, it's a broken way to get people to do better work. If they do worse work, slower. Reading books, there's a thing that's active in U.S. schools right now. Pizza Hut has a thing where we'll give you a free pizza for every book you read. Alfie Cohen makes the joke because of the idea that if you do this and you'll get that contingency, you end up hating the this and liking and focusing on the that. He's like, what you should really do is give people free books for eating pizza, because you don't want people eating pizza, but you do want them liking books. You should reverse it. It's so stupid. There's a study that shows that even thinking about rewards for 5 minutes, you're not going to get a reward. You think about getting a reward for 5 minutes, then do a task, and you still screw up the task. So crazy amount of breadth here on these studies, right? So why do we care about extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation? I mean, just pay people to do the things they're going to do, and, like, I mean, that seems fine, right? Well, the reason is because this. Intrinsic motivation appears to be, based on the data, highly superior to extrinsic motivation. You do things better when you want to do them as opposed to when you're being paid to do them. Along multiple axes. Creativity, you do better art, you solve problems more creatively. You do higher quality, and in fact, you work faster. You solve problems faster, especially if they require things like creativity. So we want intrinsic motivation. Also, intrinsic motivation makes you happy. That's kind of the Chicks and Mahaly flow stuff, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So let's talk about how this research works. I'm going to give you, like, kind of the, like, super quick glossary of if you wanted to do some of this, read some of these papers yourself, you'll be able to figure out what the hell these people are talking about. I can be precise when I'm summarizing it. So there are two or three different categories of what they call rewards, and they use the word reward in a kind of, like, technical way, but there are tangible rewards, and by that they mean things like here's some money, or even here's a gold star. There are verbal rewards, where they give you verbal feedback, and there's modulators on all these. This slide fills up with words here in a second. And there's symbolic rewards. Most people, so like an Xbox Live achievement would be a symbolic reward, right? Except gold stars, most of the studies actually do not find a difference between symbolic and tangible rewards. So usually they just separate out between tangible and verbal. But it's useful because it's the obvious thing to come to mind when we're talking about in virtual worlds. What does a pixel on the screen mean? Well, in general, these guys would say that's a tangible reward. There's whether the reward was expected or unexpected, all of these categories change what's happening. The results are different for depending on how you change all of these knobs. Expected versus unexpected, whether you think you're going to get the reward or not, or it's a surprise. Informational versus controlling rewards. So I can tell you a piece of feedback that says you killed five orcs, Or I can say, you killed five orcs just like you should have, right? And the latter is controlling and the former is merely informational. And obviously that's a pretty like hazy thing. Like there's a lot of words, like there's a lot of these papers talk all about how, you know, specific words were used in the controlling test versus not the controlling test and things like that. So this is like, I mean, this is not like hard information. It's like there's definitely wiggle room here. There's what is the task contingency of the reward? Non-task contingent rewards are if you show up and do this study, we'll give you $1, right? Without any regard to what the reward is at all, right? Or what the task is. There's engagement contingent tasks where if you start solving these puzzles, we'll give you $1. There's completion contingent, right? If you finish these puzzles, we'll give you $1. And performance contingent, if you do well at these puzzles, if you solve them faster or better or whatever, then we'll give you $1, right? So those are the contingents, how the rewards are contingent. There's how do you measure what intrinsic motivation is? There's two basic ways that they do it. One is called free choice, the free choice paradigm. That is what they did with the puzzles, right? They watch you in a room when you have other things that you could do, right? Like there's some puzzles, there's some magazines there, and whatever. That obviously seems like the pure one, right? As opposed to self-reported, which is like, how motivated are you? You know, what did you like this topic? You kind of instinctively have doubt about what people's like reported motivation is. You want to kind of measure it intrinsically, and this is where some of the fMRI research is. Like, let me try and like look inside your brain to see if you're intrinsically motivated. But however, like as Alfie Cohn points out when he's talking about how these different categories work, like the free choice paradigm, the free choice measurement is not necessarily more rigorous because like it could have more to do with the magazines that you present as the alternative than the intrinsic motivation of the thing. So you got to be careful with all of these things, right? Dull versus interesting tasks, totally different results for dull versus interesting tasks. Transitory versus long-lasting, whether the effect happens immediately or whether it happens over time. And then the final category on this thing is endogenous versus exogenous rewards. The best example is like if you read a book and I give you $1 for reading that book, that's an exogenous reward, right? If I give you another book for reading that book, that's endogenous. It's within the task itself or at least highly related versus a completely separate like, you know, random thing. Okay. Here's an example of the research. I'm not going to go into this. I'm going to show you how they actually think about this. So at the top, so there's all statistic error bars and stuff underneath. At the top, there's all rewards, and they sum it up. Okay, so the all rewards is D is negative, so that means as a general summation, all rewards are on free choice behavior have a negative impact on intrinsic motivation, except for the error bars are really big, so then you break it up. Okay, verbal rewards actually don't if they're unexpected and more informational. Tangible, unexpected rewards have almost no effect, blah, blah, blah. You can go down these things, and there's multiple, like here it is for self-reported interest. Here's a different paper written by behavior that tried to refute some of the things, but you can see that some of these are negative here as well. And so what I decided to do, first off, a little bit of history here. So basically, like Skinner started in '53. And Desi and those guys started in the 70s. There were studies in the 60s that people couldn't explain. Basically, they tried to do extrinsic motivation, and it turned out people didn't like it, didn't like doing what they were doing, as opposed to like what behaviorism would predict. And so people started doing studies specifically about intrinsic motivation, and then there were hundreds of these by the 80s. And so people started doing these meta-analyses. So this one came out, and then this one, and then these guys came out. Cameron is a behaviorist. This paper disagreed with the previous ones and said they did the wrong analysis. And then these guys came out and said, nuh-uh, and these guys are uh-huh, and then nuh-uh, and then uh-huh. And like, it really is... it's much more like a schoolyard, like, brawl. Like, it's just... You read these papers, and you're like, you people are professional, like, PhD psychologists. And like those little snark, I mean, they're peer-reviewed papers in journals, and they're like the supposed with like italics. You're just like, how old are you people? What it really made me do is it made me long for the days when this is the kind of talk I used to do in 1999, and like it's so easy. All right, So, but I figured, okay, what's a way that we can like kind of like at least get something out of this? And I decided what I'll do is, so in the meta-analyses, even the behaviorists, in the latest ones, still have to acknowledge that, even let's say they're biasing all of their numbers and all their meta-analyses and all these like, you know, quote unquote supposedly objective things, they still agree that intrinsic motivation is decreased in certain cases. Let's take that at least as ground truth, right? Like, we can at least say that if the behaviorists are having to admit that this is true. So here's what they agree on. Four interesting tasks. Tangible, expected, contingent, any kind of contingent rewards reduce free choice intrinsic motivation. That's pretty huge. They also agree that verbal, unexpected, informational, non-controlling feedback increases intrinsic motivation. Okay? Now, verbal is important here because it's not clear, there's been no studies about, as to my knowledge, about whether like the computer giving you verbal feedback or is the same as the examiner giving you verbal feedback, you know, how to do that. So like this is more stuff that we need. I don't know whether just hearing the fact that you got an achievement it doesn't do any damage, but seeing it on the screen does, or I have no idea. This is again, a plea for more research under here, but this is important stuff. This first one is key. Like this is the way rewards work in society in general. They're usually tangible. It might be a bonus check. It might be a gold star. It might be, you know, they're expected. Like, if you do this, we'll get something. And they're contingent about you doing something, whether it's performance contingent or just even engagement contingent. And free choice intrinsic motivation is kind of what you do when you want to do something, right? Like, that's really huge. But the question is, how do they extend to games? And I don't know. I mean, you can tell by those kind of like the now that you know how they are measuring this stuff, like that seems pretty close to the way that normal game motivation systems work. That's scary to me. There's this concept that's kind of happened over the past couple of years of what people call gamification of real life. And it's very closely related to this kind of pop behaviorism that Cohn is talking about, where people are talking about, oh, if we just put in, you know, game structures on real life, we'll be able to get people to do things we want them to do that are good for them. And so this talk by Jesse Schell, and there's three people coming up that I'm going to kind of like call out for end quote. I've talked to all of them except for one of them ahead of time, and like these are all friends and colleagues, and I respect all of these people highly, but I'm going to point out things that they're saying that appear to be incorrect. So Jesse Schell had this talk at DICE this year, and it kind of went around the boing boing style blogosphere as well and got a lot of press. And I'm going to play a couple snippets from it.
And you're like, oh, good job. You're getting 2,000 points from the state for getting such good grades, and you're getting 5,000 as a parent from the Obama bonus for the good parenting bonus, which you're excited because you can use that as tax relief. And then you say, hey, wait a minute. Did you practice your piano? And she's like, yeah, I practiced my piano. Well, what score did you get? He's like, oh, well, I got 150,000. 150,000, that's the best you've ever had on that particular sonata. That's 9,000 points given by the Arts Council for your scholarship fund. So, you know, go you, right? And our grandchildren will know every book that we read. That legacy will be there. It will be remembered. And you get to thinking about how, wow, is it possible maybe that since all this stuff is being watched and measured and judged, that maybe I should change my behavior a little bit and be a little better than I would have been?
So the data shows no. If you feel like you're under surveillance, you do worse. Raff, in response to this, said, we don't seem to have any issues. So people were saying, oh, this might not be a good future. And Raff said on his blog, we don't have any issues with rewards even that are even more tangible, like giving your kid money for straight-A report card. Well, actually, some people do have issues with that. Data shows that if you pay people for grades, their grades go down. So there is, as Daniel Pink says, a disconnect between what science seems to know and what we actually do, because pop behaviorism is so suffused throughout our consciousness. Jane McGonigal, another awesome, very smart person and I like very much, I took off pop behaviorism because she actually like is much more careful to not make some of these same mistakes with the like just completely obvious extrinsic motivators. There was a rant session a couple years ago, but she does talk about gamifying lots of things like Nike Plus and having ranking systems and all of the things that are still extrinsic motivators, but not quite as blatant as point systems. And so, but I want to play a more positive quote from her that still concerns me because I think this stuff is really subtle. So here's what Jane had to say. So John, at her rant, she was talking about some of the gamification stuff in the 2008, and John Blow got up and asked a question about frequent flyer miles, or had a statement saying frequent flyer miles to me seemed like a lose for a bunch of different reasons. And this is what Jane said. She agreed. Hello.
This is something your example of frequent flyer miles is great because it's something I worry about a lot. People talk about turning things into being game-like because they have like points or rewards, and it's bullshit. And there are, like, consultants who spend a lot of time, who've never made a game, who go off and say, I can make your, you know, website more like a game or your promotion more like a game. They're not game designers. They're not game developers. They don't care about games. I'm talking about people who care about games and who understand the beauty of play.
And I totally agree with the beauty of play part. I worry about when we put the extrinsic motivators on there that we're actually doing damage to the thing we're actually trying to do. Here's an awesome quote that I found. It was talking about Sony's way behind on the achievements thing, and so they're going to do this trophy thing. It's going to be great. And then the guy, the reporter who was talking about a speech from one of the Sony guys talking about how our trophies are going to be better than achievements or whatever, editorialized in the middle of, it would be brilliant if you got, say, money credited to your PSN account for finishing games. You know, a real-life reward. That'd get you playing. Yes, we can pay people to play games. Like, but why are we making games if we're having to pay people to play them? There's all these people, the bullshit people that Jane was dissing, who are consultants who are adding point systems and rewards and hierarchies, and without any knowledge about what it's doing, they're taking kind of more raw Skinnerian psychology without taking this more advanced look at things and what it actually does to what you really care about. This one's awesome. This is a company called I Love Rewards. They have ilovereward.com. Like, it is totally obvious what these people are all about, and they are not ashamed of it at all. It's a, you know, I don't know if these people are wrong or not, but there is a lot of data out there that is pretty close, and I think we need to study this to keep our art form healthy. Our art form is the only one where the kind of mechanisms for these feedback loops are built into the actual thing. Like, you know, to give someone a reward for reading a book, you actually have to do something outside that book. But that's not actually true in a game. Like, you're always giving feedback to the player. You're constantly popping stuff up on the screen. It's just it's three lines of code to say you killed five orcs. So we could do it without thinking about it. And we need to think about it. It's important to note that all of the results I'm talking about the decreasive intrinsic motivation, is for what are called interesting tasks. Tasks where there is intrinsic motivation to start with, potentially. There's a ton of data about dull tasks, and extrinsic motivators don't destroy intrinsic motivation for dull tasks, because there is no intrinsic motivation for dull tasks. And there's a ton of data that shows, you know, there's, you know, various varying data, there's various data that shows that, you know, what happens with the, you know, what happens with, like, you know, accuracy of results and blah, 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 if you're extrinsically motivating someone for a dull task versus just asking them to do blah, blah, blah. And I was going to present all this dull task data, and I was like, why would I bother presenting this dull task data? Like, look, why are you making games? If you are intentionally making dull games with variable ratio extrinsic motivators that are geared towards separating people from their money, then you have my pity. Because another thing that psychology research shows is that money above the poverty line does not make you happy. So you're wasting your fucking life. Like, if you're making intrinsically interesting games, and you're honestly trying to make cool games, and you just want to make them better, and you think, hey, extrinsic motivators, it's cool. Like, I see my friends having fun with achievements. Maybe I'll add those. Well, you have to be very careful, because you might be rotting things out from the inside. I don't know if we are. Again, this is not me saying they're wrong. I don't know yet. I mean, so, all right, ready? So Aristotle has this concept, and it kind of goes back to Plato, of virtue. So, like, everything has a virtue. Like, a knife's virtue is its sharpness. And back in their day, the example they use is a horse's virtue is its speed and the fact that it can carry things, right? And Aristotle says that, like, basically, like, if you want happiness, you need to be true to the virtue of your thing. And then they spend a ton of time talking about, you know, what is the virtue of a human being and its thought and blah, blah, blah. But, like, games have a virtue, and it's interactivity. Like, interactivity is the, like, kind of soul of games. And so being true to that is the path to happiness if you believe in this kind of philosophy. Rousseau has these two concepts of amour de soi and amour propre, and I'm totally mispronouncing those, but amour de soi is, they both mean self-esteem or self-love. But the top one means the self-esteem that you get internally from feeling like a job well done or whatever. The bottom one is the self-esteem you get from people telling you you're awesome. And Rousseau's claim is that you cannot be happy basing your life around the second one, around Amour Propre. Hey, French people, am I pronouncing them correctly? And the only true path to happiness is the one that comes from inside. And there's some data and some more modern quote-unquote philosophy, like Csikszentmihalyi's stuff, about flow theory and how people are really happy when they're doing interesting things. And it turns out that you have to have an autotelic task. What that means is a task that where the means of the task is the end itself. Like, doing the thing is compelling itself. You might get somewhere or whatever, but like, the thing itself contains within it, why you're doing it. And that's intrinsically motivating. And so, there's a whole bunch of both, like, completely insane Greek and whatever philosophy, and, to like, kind of more modern, more psychologically based flow theory that talk about this kind of inherent intrinsic thing. And this is, we have the opportunity in games to like, really play to this, and I think that, we should. So here's my doomsday slide. This is everything goes wrong. So this is the nightmare self-fulfilling scenario. Okay, let's say you want to make an awesome, intrinsically interesting game, and you do it. Congratulations. Now, being someone who wants your players to have a lot of fun, and you think this extrinsic motivator thing might work, because why not? I mean, the old theory used to be that extrinsic motivators just stack on top of intrinsic motivators, right? This is before they realized they actually rot out from underneath. So you add extrinsic motivators to make your game better. Now, if these studies actually apply to games, now all of a sudden you're destroying intrinsic motivation to play your game. And now here comes the trick of it. There's a thing I'm starting to call metrics fetishism. So the game industry used to use no metrics whatsoever, right? Everything we did was gut and by the seat of our pants. We had no idea what we were doing. And then metrics started coming around. And now we're kind of addicted to metrics. Like, we think metrics are the most amazing thing. If I can, like, if I, you know, change the RGB value of my purple hat, you know, by one unit, like 14 more people click on it and buy that hat, like, we think we're, like, totally in the zone. And that is missing the point. Because what that can do is lead you down this primrose path. Extrinsic motivation works for dull tasks. If your metrics are measuring what your extrinsic motivators are working for, it will lead you towards designing dull tasks. And you will end up with games, you're totally designing yourself into making shitty games that you have to keep paying people to play. As a bonus, women get even more demotivated by extrinsic motivators. So not only are we making shitty, boring games, we're making them all for 18 to 35-year-old men. It sounds a lot like the fucking game industry we work in right now. Okay. So we need to be careful. Okay, common buts. This is like what people say. Players love them. Our data shows that they work. We make lots of money. Just ignore them if you don't like them. They show players different ways of playing. All of these are, there's interesting stuff about all these. I'm going to be a little flip in dismissing the top three because this is basically, my talk is about, we don't know whether they work or not. We're not studying the right stuff yet. But here is the gaming, meaning gaming like slot machines. Here are their revenues. They're about 3 to 5 times our revenues in the United States. So there are people who do this a lot better than we do if you're interested in making those kinds of things. This is the best thing about this slide. Do you notice that the amount does not include deepwater cruise ships, cruises to nowhere, or non-casino devices? I love the idea of cruises to nowhere when it comes to these like basic Skinner boxes that we're creating. If you want to get on that cruise ship, be my guest. But just ignore them. So here's the problem with that. So, okay, I turn off achievements, but if the research applies, let's say the research works. I mean, if the research is bullshit, then it doesn't matter. Like, achievements, go. But if it does work, if it does apply, then players who aren't ignoring them are not, to their knowledge, because they're players, they're not trained to, like, that's why they're not game designers either. They're being unwittingly affected by this intrinsic motivation reduction, which changes everything about the playing environment for everybody, especially in a connected world. Here's an example from Casey Muratori, a good friend of mine, when I was talking about this talk. I'm just going to read it because it's like, it's exactly what we're talking about here. He turns off achievements. I used to play Gears of War Online. That game had a restriction where you couldn't get achievement points for online play unless you played ranked matches. I don't give a fuck about achievements, but I had to play ranked matches all the time anyway because no good players would ever play unranked. But of course, ranked matches don't allow you to play with your friends, because that might aid you in cheating. So you have to do ridiculous machinations to actually play a decent game with your friends, like trying to narrow the possible servers, then joining and unjoining games before they started until you saw your friend pop up on the board. Like, this is warping the play experience only based on this external, extrinsic motivator. There's nothing inherent about the run and gun, hide awesomeness of, you know, shooter, like first person shooter awesomeness of Gears of War that has anything to do with this. It all is the extrinsic metagame stuff that's happening, that's warping this experience. But they show different play styles. Like achievements show people that you can play like the first level with only a knife, and that's fun. And if the designers decide, oh, that's an interesting thing you want people to do, that's great. But you know what? Before achievements existed, people used to do these kinds of things. There were speed runs, there were permadeath runs. People would say, okay, I'm going to only do the thing with a knife. You can point things out to people. You can point out different play styles without giving them a gold star for achieving one of them. Like the conflation of the different play style, like pointing things out to people, and you have to extrinsically motivate them to do it, is false. Those aren't necessarily bound together. So when Alfie Kohn wrote these books, people would ask him, you know, snotty people in the audience that when he would give these talks about this stuff, they would be like, oh, so you're not being paid for your consulting gigs anymore? And he's like, no, that's not the point. People need to be paid a fair price. But when I negotiate a deal for a consulting thing or a speaking engagement, what I do is I negotiate a fair price up front, and then I get that payment as far out of my mind as possible. I knew I negotiated a fair thing, and I know that I have to get the payment completely out of mind to do my best work. So that kind of like gotcha kind of thing. So what's my plan? Like, I'm working on a game. I hope to eventually have it on Xbox Live and PSN and that sort of thing. So what am I going to do? Well, the first thing I'm going to do is hope that somebody listens to this talk and actually starts doing more studies about how this stuff really affects games, because maybe that will actually change things. Or maybe I'm just wrong and that's fine. Hey, I'll lard it up with achievements. I also hope, if it's still unclear, I hope they become optional. You may not know this, but you cannot pass cert on Xbox without giving away a certain number of achievements. So even if I'm philosophically, deeply, religiously believing in this stuff, I can't make my game and put it on Xbox, which is an awesome platform for indie experimental games, like totally awesome, but I can't actually release it there without putting achievements in. And so if even that fails and they don't become optional, I'm going to follow some guidelines. And so you can take this research, and these people have like kind of created some guidelines for if you are forced in certain circumstances to do rewards, how you can minimize the damage, or as Alfie Kohn says. So first, you don't make a big fuss about them. You don't like, woohoo, you got the achievement. You just can put it up. It's like fine. You don't have to like, you know, you don't make it the center of the tension. You try to the extent that you can make them unexpected. This is really hard, especially with forums and games that are played and have the same kind of thing. Like, the research talks about, it's very difficult to not have unexpected rewards become expected rewards. It's very even difficult to do studies about unexpected rewards, because you have to keep surprising the person to keep it unexpected. Use absolute, not relative measures. The data shows that things like grading on a curve are the biggest destroyers of this sort of thing. Like, you have to say, like, you know, if you killed 5 orcs, then you kill 5 orcs. It's not, oh, well, somebody else killed 7 orcs, so now you're bumped down a thing. Like, have them absolute performance measures, not people competing with each other for a limited number of them. Use endogenous rewards. Give them a sword for killing something, not some completely other random thing. You know, like, so it's part of the thing. It's the whole give someone a book if they're reading books. And make them as informational as possible and non-controlling. So here's my call to action. The industry needs to start studying the long-term impact of this stuff on players, or else we risk the doomsday scenario. And I don't know whether the doomsday scenario is going to happen, but Microsoft Research, Stanford, these places have a ton of really smart psychologists who work for them, and I want them to, MSR could probably do an awesome Xbox Live achievement study without even doing a new study. They probably have so much gathered data from telemetry there that they might be even able to do a study just by data mining. I don't know. There are a lot of smart people in that area, and like I implore them to start studying this stuff. And we, as developers, need to be better versed in the literature, because it's just, and reading the like caveats in the discussion sections of these papers, they take great care and they still manage to screw it up when they're trying to do studies about how to actually test the differences between these things. Like, it's very subtle. The word should take something from informational to controlling. Like, just the wording of the achievements and stuff, it's just incredibly subtle and dangerous. So let's be careful out there. That's my talk. I guess we have time for questions for the first time in the history of my GDC lectures. That's slightly terrifying. Are there questions? Yes.
So I just had a quick question. So what happens in your mind when you have an intrinsic reward? So for example, like you were just giving an example, I run around and I, you know, knife so many people or whatever, and then you have an external reward that kind of matches up. What do you see from the player's perspective when that intrinsic lines up with the extrinsic? Is that creating the optimal experience?
Well, I think that's what they're saying with endogenous ones. They still do damage, but they do less damage than a completely exogenous reward, which is like, here's some points, or here's the thing, you know? Points are interesting because points can be both feedback mechanism and informational feedback mechanism, and they're kind of like more informational in some sense, but like, let's say you get like a big gold star, like you knife 40 dudes, that's an extrinsic, exogenous reward for knifing dudes. The intrinsic reward, such that it is, for knifing dudes is knifing dudes, right? It's fun to go around knifing dudes. Like that, there's no extra, like, it's just a blast. So that's the intrinsic reward there. There's no such thing as something more intrinsic than an endogenous reward that is, it just becomes intrinsic. Like, it's fun to run around knifing dudes.
Right. I think I was just looking at it as more of a, like a personal goal, so.
Right. Oh, personal goals, yeah. I mean, there's actually there's so much data out there. Like, there's a bunch of stuff about goals that's really, kind of weird and like competition. Like, it depends on what you're trying to do. Like, are we trying to encourage players to be creative problem solvers or what? Like, there's a bunch of stuff there that I didn't get into but I encourage you to read these books. Like, there's a bunch of stuff out there. Is there more?
Yeah, I just had a question about just the very definition of achievements as extrinsic rewards. You know, as I've been following this debate developing online, sometimes it sounds to me like people are saying, you're like, can you imagine a world in which people are playing games just to be rewarded with points? You know, can you imagine soccer if people were just kicking balls into goals in order to see a number go up on a scoreboard?
Right.
You know, games are about interactivity, but aren't they also all about arbitrarily applauding certain outcomes
outcomes?
And so where does the line really sit here?
Right, I mean, yes, of course we can all imagine that world because that's the world we used to live in, right?
Like, well, isn't that the world we still live in? I mean, those orcs didn't do anything to me, right? Like, I'm killing those orcs because the game said that that's the good outcome. Right? And I'm being rewarded with points or I'm being rewarded with XP. That's what games are.
I'm just saying, like, I mean, the reason kids play ball is because it's fun to play ball. They don't do it for the points, right? And, like, the point thing becomes larded on. And it's unclear, like, you know, there are studies about sports and how competition and that sort of thing. But I think the concept of, like, the concept seems really clear to me. Like, you play games, like, before there were rewards, you play games for playing the games. And a lot of people still play games for playing the games. But now there's this new thing, which is I play games for achievements. Or whatever.
Right, I play games better in order to get a higher score, right? I mean, like, I get better at basketball in order to sink more of the ball into the hole so the number goes up, right?
Well, but did you do it because it's pleasurable to do it or for the number to go up? We shouldn't have a conversation but the score is interesting. This is why I think we need more data. Like, I'm not saying score is an extrinsic motivator versus a non-controlling informational feedback thing. I don't know how it functions. But it certainly gives feedback when you actually do it right.
Cool. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. There needs to be more studies. That's, I mean, the fundamental thing.
So I wanted to get back to, you asked this question about why I talk about dull tasks. And when you were talking about all this motivation stuff, you were thinking about motivation for playing games. But I was thinking about two different things. One is motivating my children, which I will not talk about right now. It's probably even more complicated than motivating gamers. But second is motivating employees. So, which shows how far I've gone from when I used to be a game programmer. But I often have to deal with this fact of motivating employees to do dull tasks. So that's actually a very interesting topic to me, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Right, so those books talk about it. I just didn't think it was appropriate here. So, like, yes, there are tasks in the world that are dull and not intrinsically motivating, and there are, you know, read Alfie Cohn's book, he talks about that, Drive talks about that, but this is not the place for that. It's too complicated. The research is like, I mean, people are, you know, the behaviorists and the non-behaviorists are like arguing about which is better way about, you know, it's like, it's not as clear cut as that, those two points, which everyone agrees on.
Okay.
So read books.
Thank you.
I'll give you a pizza.
So I'm guessing that, When the people, for example, in the puzzle anecdote stopped playing with the puzzle,
yeah.
they maybe found something else interesting to do that right. they hadn't been asked to do. So I'm wondering, had you considered maybe using your XBLA achievements to reward really dull actions in your game that you don't want your players to do?
Yeah, that's
and then maybe they'll play with some other parts of your game that you want them to play with.
Who knows? I mean, that's Alfie Cohn's point with the jokey pizza, invert the pizza book thing. Like, yeah, I mean, but it doesn't really, I mean, people do things that they're told to do that they get a reward for even without thinking about it necessarily. So it's not, the fear I have is that by rotting out the intrinsic motivation, they'll just slowly stop liking playing your game and perhaps an area of games around it. I don't know if how there are studies that show that it does ooze into other similar areas. So yeah, it's hard to say.
Hi, I'm Ryan from Untold Entertainment. In your Doomsday scenario, you're talking about dull non-games that reward boring tasks, and women are more affected by this impact of not being motivated than men. I know you weren't talking about Farmville, but. If you were talking about Farmville, they were just here this morning and they said that they made something pink and it did better because there are so many women playing Farmville, so that would appear to be at odds.
Right, it's very important. This is why I tried to make this distinction and maybe it didn't come across clearly. Like, people will do things for extrinsic motivators. That is a fact. You can get someone to do something. The question that I think is interesting, and this is why I say I claim that there are no studies about this for games, the question is whether they have intrinsic motivation. So if you're doing something for an extrinsic motivator, you take away the motivator and it goes away. And you might like loathe yourself for doing it even while you're doing it. There's a whole bunch of like crazy studies about like if you're being paid to do something, you know, that is unpleasant, like how you feel and whatever. But my question is, are we disincenting people for playing games for the beauty of play? Like, are we going to have to continue just paying people to play? Right?
Okay, thanks. Hi. So, not to pick on Farmville more, because it seems like a decent game, but...
Speak up, I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
So, not to pick on, like, Farmville, because it seems like a decent game, but it seems like kind of the prime example of what you're talking about here, you know, in terms of extrinsic motivation.
Right.
But it's clearly had a lot of success.
Yeah.
Do you think that games that are more based on intrinsic motivation might be at a commercial disadvantage?
I don't know. I mean, part of that feedback loop in the Doomsday scenario is worried about that. Like, once you start paying people, like, here, the analogy that a lot of these books use, just to simplify, like, a lot of the dull task extrinsic motivator thing, is the first time you pay your kid to clean up his room, you then have to pay your kid to clean the room every other fucking time. Right? It's toast. Like, you once you have made a commercial relationship between that, you're doomed. And so, like, by taking those steps, I worry that we take steps off cliffs, not just, like, take steps that we can then peel back on. So, yeah, I don't know.
Thanks.
Yep.
So, in a lot of the research you cited, it seems like the relationship between the person being rewarded and the rewarder was a one-to-one relationship of that person getting a reward. But the motivator in a lot of social games and online games and MMOs is one of status, right?
Right.
Of my relationship to other people, and that seems kind of intrinsic to competitive games in general. And I'm wondering if there are studies that looked at that particularly about, like, if that is considered by psychologists to be an extrinsic or intrinsic reward, my relationship to other people.
Right. I think that's a relatively new thing. There were some studies. I wanted to present stuff here that was just basically unimpeachable. But there are some studies about that. I think it's too early and they haven't really isolated the stuff. So of course you get the behavior saying, no, it increases. And then the other one's going, no, it doesn't. You know, so like they're still in the arguing it out, like battle, like fighting in the play yard part on that. So, but yeah, this question of how does social, I mean, the social games nowadays are so able to amp up the sociality. Like normal games, like you play, have that. Even just board games, there's a social hierarchy thing that's going on and things like that. But I think it's a new opportunity to study that stuff now that we have social games where it's just like so turned to 11.
But just to be clear, the way you depicted that pointed to an evaluation of social status as an extrinsic reward.
Yeah, I don't know. Some of these they separate out status from verbal and tangible rewards. So basically, I'm saying I don't know the answer. Like, I think no more study is needed there too. But you can read. There is some data about that out there, and I think it's still in that, like, you can't do the meta-analysis and get a summary of it yet.
Hi. Can you switch back to that slide where you had the pity line?
Where I had the what?
Where you had the pity line, where you have pity for the people who are making dull games.
The pity... Which slide? Tell me when to stop. I don't know what you're talking about.
That one. Why are you making games? Yeah, that.
This one?
Yep. Okay. Can you just leave it on that? I just want to copy it later. Also, on the other hand, how much would it cost for you to send it to me framed on a plaque?
I was intrinsically motivated to do this talk, and so I will give it to you for free.
Oh, all right. I'm lucky that.
In fact, if you have a USB key drive, I'll give it to you right now. No, that's actually not true, but send me email.
All right, sure thing.
Yes.
I was wondering how you felt about a system that was in Mass Effect 1 where achievements mapped to rewards in game, like increased strength of your player for killing X amount of enemies. It was a reward more along the lines of a quest built into the game as opposed to something completely removed. Something similar was in Uncharted 2 as well.
Right. I mean, that's what I was saying about the endogenous stuff. Like, the more closer you can make it, it seems to do less damage. It still does damage because it is this thing that kind of pulls you out and is rewarding you for something that you already were. So there's this, okay, so the theory behind why, one of the leading theories about why intrinsic motivation is destroyed is something called the overjustification effect. And what the overjustification effect says is that if you're doing this to get that, when you finish this, right, and you achieve, and you get that, and you have a certain pleasure, you attribute the pleasure to the that and remove it from the this. So any pleasure that you got from playing the game, you put onto the reward, and so you remember the play experience as less interesting than it actually was. So you over-justify the result of the thing. So that's why even endogenous rewards can, like, so basically I give you a book because you read a book, and now you're like, wow, I got a book, that's awesome. Not, man, I really enjoyed this book I just read. So even endogenous is fraught with peril, is basically the deal.
Okay. So I was thinking about the motivation for a talk on motivation, and sort of like the industry headline or the other title for this talk really is Game Industry Saved by a Six-Year-Old Girl.
Yes, with a really cute hat on.
Hello, would you consider the high score table in Pac-Man, would you consider that similar to what we have nowadays with achievements?
Yes, yeah, that's what I was trying to get to with the points thing. I don't know how points and high score tables, so there's a bunch of, like, I didn't even go into this because this seems much more controversial, but Alfie Cohn has a book called No Contest, which talks about how competition is really screwed up if you really want people to excel. What he claims is the worst thing you can do if you want excellent work out of people is separate them out into teams, have them compete for a reward that there's only one of. And you'll get shittier work from both teams. So, like, there's a ton of research about competition that's actually really questionable, especially given, I mean, I love, Counter-Strike is my favorite game, right? Like, I love competitive online environments. Like, my game that I'm making, Spy Party, is a competitive online game. And so I'm kind of just not reading that book because I just can't even be depressed if that's also bad, too. I just don't even know what I'll think. But, So, I don't know how points function. That's one of the things that these guys don't actually study, because they're actually studying real world things, and I want someone like from MSR or wherever, Stanford or Michigan or whatever, these, you know, to do some studies on games. I mean, most of the studies done on games are about game addiction. The psychologists do on games are about game addiction. It's interesting, there's a bunch of the studies point towards it's actually intrinsic motivating factors that make games addicting, which is kind of bizarre. So, like, let's make our games more intrinsically motivating, and then we'll have more of an addiction problem. But that's a separate topic. But, I want someone to do a study about this intrinsic motivation thing, but the problem is, one of the reasons I think people haven't done it is because, like, most people don't actually care about the intrinsic motivation power of games except for us. So there's not a lot of, like, you know, game addiction matters to people. It's like, my child is addicted to games. Whereas, like, whether games are destroying themselves from the inside out slowly, like, who cares about that except for us, because it's our art form. So there's not a lot of incentive. That's why I'm hoping someone from MSR will do this, because they actually have an incentive. Like, Xbox Live is awesome, and they want to keep it awesome. And so they have some incentive to do that, and that would be great, because there's a ton of really super genius psychologists. There probably are philosophers there, too. Psychologists working at MSR. So anyway.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hey. Great talk, by the way. Like, did you consider, like, the concept of having feedback loop as being a reward as well? Like, for example, on Far Cry 2, we had this issue with killing animals, and then we ended up deciding that no feedback would be more disturbing than anything else. So, as weird as it may sound, in Far Cry 2, it's more pleasant to kill someone with a machete than to kill an actual animal. So, like, did you thought about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't, like, games are really weird because, like I said, they're, like, Most of these studies are done about things where the feedback loop, and games have a feedback loop, period. Like, I push a button on the controller, it goes in, it gets computed, it comes out on the screen or audio, and I see it. So, like, there's something happening there already. Like, most of that is informational. Like, most of the time we do UI design and controller design and all that kind of stuff, it's basically like, who did I shoot? Yes, did he die? No, whatever. That's non-controlling information. So, to the extent, I think, that we try and make it less controlling, most games when you're aiming, don't tell you, good job, you should have shot him in the head, right? They just say, you shot him in the head and he died, right? So I think that we're probably, a lot of those kind of, like, I think a lot of the inherent feedback loops in games are falling into that just informational feedback, not tangible or even, you know, rewards. So
good, thanks. Yep.
Hi. I don't understand why you're not convinced and why you have a question mark at the beginning of your talk and why you don't take a stronger stance against this very important
Because I want
issue.
My game to go on Xbox Live at some point and I don't want them to blacklist me.
Is that your real answer? Or is
no,
that
I mean, I don't... I mean, like this slide, like, I... This part of the talk is real for me. Like, you read these papers and you're just like, these fucking people, like... They're battling it out in these peer-reviewed journals, and they're just clearly totally biased, and, like, psychology research makes me nervous. Like, I'm a technical person, right? Like, I don't necessarily buy it. Like, with global warming, you know, it's like, you read the emails from the ClimateGate thing, and, like, the dude was an ass, right? Like, he's basically saying, let's hide this data. And, like...
Even those 2 points that everyone agreed on, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'm just saying, like, it's... What... When you read this research... The thing you come away with, like if you look at things like this, is you take one turn and all of a sudden it has no effect on intrinsic motivation. So what these guys do a lot on both sides, and what the fundamental problem with pop behaviorism is that it tries to extend things from pigeons to humans. So I don't want to extend this research to achievements without actually having a real data on it. So I'm just trying to be careful. Like, I just get nervous around this stuff, you know? Like, I think we owe it to our art form to actually do the real data, not just make more assumptions and more anecdotal bullshit, and then, like, I mean, for every forum post about, like, I don't play games anymore because achievements suck, you'll find, like, fuck, man, it's so awesome when I've got, like, 3,000 gamer points from this one thing. Who's right? It's anecdotes. That's not research. So we need to do it, the real research.
All right.
Thank you for the applause.
Just quick last comment. I'm pro-research just like you. You're afraid that taking some action prematurely might be bad, but taking no action is a pretty risky bad thing, too.
So you read this article and you're like, the fundamental thing you come away with is, like, these guys, and I believe in global warming, like, I'm not a science researcher, but but it seems like the overwhelming evidence, but they're basically, like, the con global warming people are basically saying, these people want us to restructure the entire global economy, and they're not even sure they're right. Like, there's a lot of invested, like, I mean, it's not, you can't just, you know, I mean, this research, I would not bet my life on this research. So, there you go.
Hi, I know there's no research on this, but I'm kind of curious as to your opinions on, so a lot of times so when players do something really, really cool in a game, sometimes they'll take a video of it and post it up online, sort of asking for a verbal reward from all the people who see them and say, wow, that's such a good job.
Right.
So is there a way to, like, have players decide when it's time for a reward and what would be the result of that?
It's interesting you mentioned that, Kate, because one of the things that the book said that I didn't even put in the slide of, like, how to fix the reward, you know, how to do rewards that don't totally fuck your game up. One of the things that Alfie Cohn mentions on page 92, as I show down there in the corner, is allow... And so there, he was talking about, like, at work, you know, rewards for, like, you know, like, don't do performance bonuses. If you're gonna give a performance bonus, let the worker decide how they're judged and when they do it. So it's basically saying exactly, I couldn't figure out how to map that to the game. So I don't know the answer to that question, but yes, if you can allow the player, I mean, well, okay, not to generalize the results. If you can allow the person being rewarded to choose how they're judged about the reward, or judge is the wrong word because you want to be as informational as possible, how the reward is kind of used in the system, it detracts less from intrinsic motivation. So you're exactly right. If you can figure out whatever the UGC of achievements is, then yeah, that would help.
Cool, thanks.
Yep.
Going back to the pity slide again, the emphasis there is that if you're doing something intrinsically interesting, but there's a few of us here that are looking at the educational and serious games and trainers and whatnot, where, yes, we'd like to say that we're not dull, But at the same time, that's hard to do in something that's not
domain
specific.
You said it, I didn't.
So is there anything in your research that helps us in that space?
Yeah, I mean, you should read the books. The books talk about dull tasks. It's, I didn't have time, and I didn't think it was like the right emphasis for the talk to talk about how to make really bad games actually. People play games that aren't interesting inherently. Like, I think the majority of people at the mainline GDC are like trying to make a good game, and they want to make it better. And that's the people I want to be careful.
Chris, thank you for an excellent talk. I think that it's incredibly relevant and provocative at this moment in time in game design when we're seeing the rise of new forms like social network games that are very, very popularly successful and also kind of reverse our expectations about what good game design is or what game design is.
Right.
So this echoes some of the other comments, but I think I love the way that you're framing this problem in part as a question about aesthetics and tied to the beauty of games themselves and the beauty of play. And I wonder, and I think part of the complexity of the question is that there's a sense in which, as opposed to most of the research examples, that as you say, rewards are part and parcel of a game. They're sort of part of the fabric of playing a game in and of itself. So that, you know, because goals are part of a game, and so that what changes a structured leisure activity like skiing into a game is that it does become a contest and there is some kind of outcome. And I think that if, as Frank Lance says, that those goals in a game are like gravity, that they help you not just give you a reward, but help you make sense of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't have finishing level 1 and then finishing level 2 or finishing level 3, or if I didn't have points in Pac-Man, it would be hard for me to know what am I doing in this space? Am I doing the right thing? Am I sort of progressing in a sense? So, and
yeah,
I think
that
and it's a gray line between those intrinsic game goals to achievements. And so the question is really what is extrinsic?
Right. Well, I think there's the issues between, I think actually my opinion on that is actually extrinsic versus intrinsic is actually more clear. There's exogenous versus endogenous extrinsic motivators. But I think the thing you're talking about is more, the thing I'm focusing on actually is more information versus control. That access is like points, things like giving you something to do that you then like learn something from, like giving that, making that informational seems to be the key to avoiding the traps there. I don't know, again, I would love to see a study on points and how they actually affect intrinsic motivation. I'm not so worried. I mean, intrinsic versus extrinsic, like, I definitely think there are subtleties there, but I think the bigger problems is the subtleties along a couple of the other axes on that characteristic slide.
I still feel that there's a way that creating games, in a sense, is dancing with the devil.
Yeah.
And that I don't think we're ever going to quite
right.
be able to separate these issues
right.
cleanly. Ambiguity is part
right.
of the beauty
of games.
Well,
so my concern about that, because it is this like art form of making games, that's my concern about metrics fetishism, is that it just leads us down this route and we just do it unthinkingly because, of course, the database query came back and said, like, purple. Right? And like, that's not, to some extent, this research shows that that's not necessarily going to lead you in the right direction. And so I worry, I think we've overcorrected on the metric side.
Thank you for an excellent talk.
Thanks.
Hi, my question is, I wonder why, because this is kind of a hot topic right now, and the viewpoints usually are pretty unilateral, and I'm wondering if you feel like there's an implicit value judgment. You know, you talk about the purity of play, and it's fun and easy to come up here and take pot shots at Farmville or whatever.
Right.
But do you think that, that it's almost like this kind of implicit judgment that people who play Farmville don't really like it because
oh,
it doesn't,
totally. No,
you know,
no,
the
yeah.
purity of
Completely.
Play and whatever. And, you know, why can't the market, if there's billions of gamers, kind of support, these different styles? So if some people
yeah.
really like it and some people don't, like, is it really that big of an issue in a field that's so big and diverse?
Right. The question for me is much more of that's why there's a slide with Aristotle on it in my talk, right? It's like it's not that like I have no problem with Farmville. I have no problem with a bunch of things. If there I have a problem with the game industry and the game form becoming kind of chasing one thing and becoming before it actually matures, right? I don't think we're very mature at all. I think we're still figuring out what the hell we're doing. And I worry that I think the beauty part is the intrinsic motivator, whether you're a social game or whether you're like, you know, hardcore Gears of War Counter-Strike. I think that intrinsic motivation carries across any, like, we want to be doing games just like people want to be writing books or want to be making music that make people better, right? That make them like, you know, better humans, that speak to the human condition, all these art things. And, slot machines show one direction where you're completely extrinsically motivated. People will do that.
So I actually was thinking about it. Do you believe that that's true? Because, you know, just knowing a little something about statistics, I find it difficult to believe that 100% of people who play slot machines, like out of all of them, no percentage, like 0% do it because they actually kind of enjoy it.
Well, wait, I mean, the thing I'm trying to show here is the, like, dirtiness of science in one sense. Like, of course it's not 100% in anything. You'll find people who like to mow the grass. Like, that's not, I mean, there's no, like, the question is what happens as a whole. Like, you have to be, you know, you can take any one person in and find exceptions. That's not, I mean, that's not, you know, once you get above math, that happens, right?
Yeah.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to be that guy, but we have to get you out of here.
All right.
Because we don't know what you're going to do unsupervised.